Welcome, everyone. My name is Joel Forrester, and this is the Ex-Military Careers Podcast. I just wanted to say an enormous shout out to all you veterans, family members, and transitioning personnel all around the world for taking the time out of your day today to join us and understand a bit more about EMC and how we support the veteran community and how we work with fantastic clients as well to bring veterans into their workforce. EMC is a not-for-profit / social enterprise, depending on whether you're in the UK or the US, whose sole purpose is to support veterans in the United States and the UK throughout the entirety of their civilian career with mentorship and different career opportunities. Whether you're leaving the forces as we speak or you've been in the civilian space for a number of years, we are here to support you. Today, I'm joined by the remarkable Sam Smith, RAF veteran and European Managing Director of Kelly OCG. Having spent some time getting to know Sam over the last few months, I'm delighted to have her join me on the Ex-Military Careers podcast and really understand more about her story from her time in the RAF to now leading one of the largest RPO firms across the globe. Sam is not only one of the most inspiring people I've really had the honor in meeting, but her resilience and her perseverance to be successful really emulates that of a veteran and the mindset that we all possess. So all the vets out there, anyone who's struggling or going through the mill, the next 30 minutes should really be something that just showcases to you that we've all been there, we've all done it, and then there's light at the end of the tunnel. So Sam, welcome.
Welcome.
Lovely to have you here. I have to say, I'm very excited. Very, very excited. So first way I love to fire these things off is throw a few random questions at you. Now, as I've got to know you a little bit over the last few months, I know you're a hockey person. So we've got some synergy there, which is amazing. So I've got three questions and I'd like you to not think too much, but just throw your first answer. So first one, a penalty stroke. When someone's shooting, where do you not like them to put it? Top left, top right, bottom left, bottom right?
Top left.
Ooh, okay. Pad side? Is that pad side or stick side?
Pad side.
Pad side, okay. Text or call?
Call.
And best hockey tour you've ever been on?
Isle of Wight.
Isle of Wight. Ah, I've done Isle of Wight a few times. Yeah, it's a great tour. Cool. Okay. Listen, Sam, thank you so much for joining. I can't wait to start talking, getting into your background, your history as an RAF veteran leading all the way to where you are now, you know, in an extremely important position with Kelly OCG. So firstly, thank you for joining. It's an absolute honor to have you here. And I guess secondly, I'd love to throw the ball over to you and say, give us an intro. Tell us a little bit about Sam.
Well, first, thanks for having me. You know, when you first mentioned this to me, I thought, great, you know, what a great opportunity to talk to somebody that, you know, has got a similar background to me and some similar interests too. So thanks for having me. But yeah, I mean, I'm very fortunate to work for Kelly. I lead Kelly OCG, which is our outsourcing and consulting group here in EMEA, and, you know, take care of our operational goals and strategy as it relates to sales and operations, delivering fantastic service to our customers, strategic alignment to many of our large global accounts, and really drive what we call a local strategy in growing the business. I have a wonderful, wonderful team and part of a fantastic business, and I love it. You know, I've been here, gosh, it'll be 8 years in March, and, you know, it's a great organisation to be in, and I feel very lucky. So, yeah, I'm one of those. So one of those people in life that just loves the company I work for, loves the people I work with, and I'm really, really lucky.
Wow, that's incredible. And I guess before we dive into understanding a bit more about your RAF career and what's led you to where you are now, one question that jumps into my mind straight away is obviously you're kind of certainly that EMEA space with Kelly OCG, you're top of the spear there. How do you manage the pressures of that and all of the demands that are on you? Obviously, I've met your incredible PA. She's fantastic, makes brilliant coffee. So other than utilizing her, how do you manage the pressures?
I have brilliant people around me, and I trust them and empower them. I think it becomes a real pressure when you don't do that. And by trusting and empowering and developing those around me to deliver their very best, that takes the pressure off of me. You know, I much rather focus on my accountability than the pressure that comes with the job, and make sure that those around me know they're trusted to deliver. And if I know, I can look at myself in the mirror every day and know that I have delivered a really good level of service to those around me. You know, I'm in a service role. My job is to give the folks that work with me a level of service, of support and guidance and mentorship, and be somebody they know they can contact when they need to. And if I can look at myself in the mirror and know I've delivered that level of service, then the pressure can dissipate. Yeah. The accountability for helping the company deliver on our commitments and goals is a very real, tangible thing for me. Yeah. But again, with the team that I have around me, both here locally and globally, you know, it feels manageable, it feels achievable, and the pressure feels less of a negative weight, but more of a positive push behind me. It's an energy rather than pressure.
Yeah. And everything you mentioned there, trust, empowerment, accountability, all falls under the leadership umbrella. So where did you learn that skill set that clearly is serving you so well now?
In every job I've been in, but of course, you know, that formative stage was both sports and the military. You know, I'm a great believer that military careers instill a sense of leadership, command, and community and collaboration that, you know, I think is hard to beat. You know, I'm not devaluing other organizations, of course, but it's a foundation that I think is really unique in people. But along the way, you know, as I've, you know, rolled through my career, I've picked things up in every organization from people I trust and believe in and have been fortunate to be mentored by or led by. Yeah. I've learned along the way and picked up elements of leadership and styles and management and communication that, you know, I've thought, wow, that's inspiring. I can learn from that. Mm. And I will continue to do that because, yeah, you know,
constant evolution.
I've got a long way to go.
Constant evolution. That's the aim of the game, I guess.
Yeah. I don't think one can ever believe they have done it, made it, or it. You continually have to recognise there's always a learning opportunity for all of us, and yeah, that's been a really important part of my development as a human. I'm a very different person today to who I was 20 years ago. And that's good, you know, and I'll be a different person in 10 years time, and that's also good.
It's interesting when you think about that, because when people join, I mean, how old were you when you joined? Because you did cadets first, right?
I did, yeah. I was literally a year for the Queen. Yeah.
So how old were you there? You must have been
17.
Yeah, and then you went straight into the RAF. So I mean, you were learning who you were as a person, let alone
a child.
Yeah, literally, right? I was saying. So, I mean, to think that, you know, you could be anywhere near the same kind of person as the person who first joined the RAF would be, you know, wouldn't make sense. So I mean, how do you feel you've developed over those years? I mean, what have you found yourself? What elements are you now really comfortable with and really assertive on as to what you may be questioning back in the day?
Yeah, I think I've smoothed out some edges. You know, I'd like to think that I've carried through some of those things like humour, right? But I've learned and built a greater level of empathy. I've have fewer scenarios where I'll, you know, get hot about something or heated about something, but still have I take things very personally. Which means I've become much more thoughtful about what that means and how to understand how emotions play a role, a positive role, as well as you know, a less positive role at times in who we are and how we react to things. I'd, you know, of course, just become much more mature in how I respond to things. But there's something beautiful about, you know, that that military environment that one operates in, because you have fewer opportunities to get hot about something. You're asked to do something, you do it. You don't question things. You may do after the account, but that's typically in the NAFI in a different environment, right? Whereas, you know, as an adult and having come through that mature cycle, you know, you do question things in a different way, but I think learning to question them in a proactive and useful, purposeful dialogue is a big learn, rather than just, you know, butting up against things. And there have been periods in my career where I've really challenged, but I've learned along the way that perhaps there are different ways of doing it.
Yeah, I think stereotypically from the military, you're taught a certain way of being, right? And then the day you leave and you step into that civilian world, which probably where a lot of people listening to this podcast are now going to be situated, there's going to be a learning curve. And so for some, it's going to be really tough. And for some, it'll be quite smooth because they'll be able to get their head around it. And I think big learning for me was actually to sometimes just slow down, think about it and work out a way to, in an inclusive way, to get to a result as opposed to an enforcive way. You know, red brain, that red brain mentality sometimes can cause more problems than it can rectify problems, I guess. So, you know, as you're very aware, the military have gone through lots of transitions from inclusivity, from diversity, all across the board, from gender to sexuality to color. Did you have any struggles back in the day that you look back on now and you've learned from?
Yeah, from a sexuality perspective, you know, I'm very comfortable with sharing mine. You know, I am a gay woman. I don't typically enjoy putting labels on things, and have in my career actually kind of stepped away from, you know, being a flag bearer. Because I didn't want my sexuality to define my career. And actually, for a very long time, for my military career included, I didn't share my sexuality. You know, it didn't, certainly wasn't right to in the Air Force. I could have landed myself in a charge situation, a court-martial situation. It was not legal, for want of a better term, until, 2000? I think we... Mm-hmm. You know, are in a position where that, and that's still very recent. You know, that's contemporary times. When you think about that, that's, you know, a shame.
However, that it was illegal until 2000. Honestly, when we looked that stat up the other day, I was quite ashamed. I am now someone who's served in the forces, parachute regiment, done a lot in my career. I'm ashamed by that. I really am.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it is a shame. However, you know, and I will not defend, you know, the institutions that have created over history a narrative around homosexuality, because, you know, I've been at the other end of what that looks and feels like as an individual. You know, the secrecy, the fact that you begin telling untruths, you know, as part of a matter of course, just to protect yourself. What did you do at the weekend? Well, you can't be honest about what you did at the weekend. So you tell an alternate view, which is, of course, an untruth, or, you know, in greater terms, it's a lie. You become a liar, and that's not great. So, you know, I think both in military and corporate terms, you know, there were times in my career where it didn't feel right to talk about my sexuality and my truth and my real life, because I didn't feel it was going to be accepted. And I think it would have damaged my position at work, my relationships at work.
And how did you feel? I guess you've got two scenarios there, one in the military, you know, and you're going back to a very young version of yourself who maybe would have struggled understanding that to a point. And then you've got the commercial world when you're a bit older, a lot more experienced. So I guess there's two versions of Sam there. How did each one process that?
Well, in the first instance, I didn't know any different, right? So, you know, firstly, coming to terms with who you are is difficult. It's difficult for anybody understanding that you are not conforming to a societal norm as it was, particularly then in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. You know, I know I'm a lot older than I look. And it, on a podcast, you can't see how young I look.
Look
for sure.
20, Sam.
Thanks very much. So, but that was my norm. You know, that was my norm growing up. I grew up in Bexhill and Sea in East Sussex, you know, a very conservative, you know, part of the country, a Tory stronghold, where language and narratives around minorities, particularly those in the LGBTQ communities, was very, very different to what it is today. And it was aggressive and unpleasant. And that then made you think, well, gosh, if I am one of those people, I'm not going to tell those people because I don't want that vitriol to then come onto me. I'm going to hide it. I'm going to pretend I'm not. I'm going to try and figure this out. And it can be quite a lonely place. Mm-hmm. But fortunately for me, you know, I was very involved in sport. You know, I had the community of sport around me. Sport was a place where your whole self could be much easier recognized. And it was a safe haven for being who I was. And the same in the military. Sport was a safe haven, and sub-communities existed, albeit not large, but gave you places where you could feel at home with being your true self. Knowing that you must hide it again, you know, when you go back to camp, back to barracks, back to the block, back to the mess, wherever it may be that you go, because it's safer to do so. There'll be very many people, and in fact, Joel, you said this to me yourself, you know, gosh, that I can't think of anybody I served with that would have had a problem with this. Mm. Well, for somebody like me, that's not how it feels. It actually feels as if many people would. And I liken it to the Premiership, you know, as a footballer. You know, many footballers may say, I wouldn't have a problem if my colleagues came out. But the percentage of footballers that do come out is so small, it proves to you that there is a problem.
I guess with that, it's more surrounding my thoughts on it and my opinions on it. Like, to me, someone's sexuality doesn't make me think A, that they're person A or person B. It's a beautiful thing about them. It's individual. You know, there should be no negativity around that. Like you know, that and I guess the people I served with, I think I served in a time when it was transitioning from mindset A to mindset B. And when I left, it was very much mindset B, which is a very positive mindset. And you know, for me, that didn't play an impact in the friendships I had. And there's a couple of friends I now have who are, well, I now have, I've had for a long, long time, who are in the civvy world now, and they've come out as being gay, and they're both guys. And I would never have known that. And actually, one question I maybe one when I over a beer with them one day, I'll ask them why they didn't feel, or what was it that made them feel not supported enough to come out in those times. And looking back now, it's an interesting thing that I guess when you are in that institution, you don't know any different. Do you know what I mean? And that's quite tough.
Yeah, it's not just about the institution, though. I think it's also of a time. You know, it was a time of existence, of social acceptance, the law, the government narratives, community narratives. It was a very, very different time. And, you know, thank goodness we're in a different time. It means that, you know, people like me, you know, can be recognized as being married, can be parents, you know, can have nuclear families that look normal, and it's still not quite normal. You know, I mean, I was, you know, probably one of the earlier same-sex marriages or same-sex relationships that had a child.
Yeah,
you know, and the interesting experience as the non-birth parent, going into a hospital environment or midwife appointments and so on, it proved very much so that even in 2010, it was a very, very different experience and a different time. So, but we are evolving and are progressing, and that makes a difference in people's work lives, makes a difference, you know, across the board. And when you add how inclusivity and diversity are leading so many conversations in the boardroom, you know, for me, it's just a win-win all around, you know, more progression, more, it's going to keep coming.
Yeah, and that's so important. One thing I would like to ask as well before I ask the next question is, we have people from the US, from the UK listening to this podcast. Anyone who's in a similar position and maybe questioning themselves, questioning their sexuality, and they're serving in the forces, what advice could you give to them from your experiences?
Find your people, you know, and create a gap for you to be your true self, no matter how small it is in the first instance, because it's suffocating and really isolating and lonely to not be that true self. And there will be people, there will be your people. Find them, bring them close, and, you know, find a way to acknowledge and accept and give yourself permission to be your own self. The legal arguments around homosexuality in the military have changed, which, you know, gives more freedom. No, I think it is just simply a case of finding those people. And those people may exist either inside or outside of your organization. In many ways, that doesn't matter, because as soon as you find a way to give yourself permission and acceptance to be yourself, it then grows. And I didn't, honestly, I didn't do that until in my career, until maybe 2012. It took a long time for me to be that and be open and out at work. But once I found that gap, then I was able to then build my confidence and grow into it. And Kelly has been a wonderful place for me to grow, incredibly inclusive and diverse as an organization. And, you know, has allowed me to celebrate my quirks and my sexuality, and, you know, the fact that perhaps I'm not a corporate clone as it relates to the way I dress and the way I look. You know, I've been embraced as me, and that's a wonderfully liberating thing to do. But you have to start somewhere and give yourself permission.
And what is it you feel that Kelly has done as a group organization to make you feel like that? And I think there's a lot of learning that can be had from your real positive experiences here.
There's normalized conversation. So it's not whispers or quiet conversation about equality and inclusion and diversity. It's about a consistent narrative that normalizes people's lives, no matter how different they are. You know, we have an active trans community in our organization. We have affinity groups. We have an open narrative. And at the very top of our organization, from a leadership perspective, a really active conversation about inclusivity and about how the business is for all and everybody to be themselves. It's an encouraged environment. And the more people like me are myself, the more it then shows a blueprint of, oh, you know, this is the norm, and, you know, normalizing behaviors and conversations. And
do you have an active veteran community in Kelly?
An active
veterans community. So obviously you are a representative there. Is it, do you know of any others that are in Kelly?
I do. And, you know, particularly in the US, we have an incredibly active approach to supporting veterans, because Europe is so split. It's not a consolidated, centralized effort, but on a country by country basis, we do have local efforts as it relates to the veterans community. Oh, the kind of cross sectionality, if you like, of veterans falling into so many other categories, whether that be, you know, millennials, whether that be black, whether it be our Latino community, whether that be the LGBTQ, that veteran stream runs across all groups, right? So that intersectionality is really, really important. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, that military and ex-military personnel are not damaged goods, are not always people carrying bullet wounds and missing limbs and mental health issues. Yes, that does exist. Of course it exists. But there are also many ex-military service personnel, men and women, that carry those injuries, whether they're visible or invisible, but also amazing levels of skill and competence that can make a big, big difference in organisations. And I think the call to action is stop treating veterans as damaged goods. You know, there's a huge level of capability and competence and energy and thoughtfulness and purpose that sits within every person, whether they're military or not. But this idea that we kind of badge veterans with this.
If I'm not careful here, Sam, you'll be taking my job, because my role here is to educate the community on exactly what you've just said, that you are, as you know, preaching to the converted, and big conversations I have, and interestingly more so US than UK with big clients, is the common question is, where do veterans fit? And I turn around and I'll be deadly honest, I've used you yesterday as an example. I've said, you know, look at a lady I know called Sam. She's in the UK. She's the MD of a massive company, and she was in the RAF. So veterans sit from C-suite all across the board, and every role, every level, and that is a massive part of my role is educating people on exactly what you've just said. And actually, those who are damaged goods can be healed, they can be helped, and they can also play an active role in companies. You know, if it's physical, that then companies are supporting people with a lack of limbs or you know, whatever their disability may be, there's still active roles for these people. And I think the beauty of where ex-military careers are being so successful for their clients, it's opening these clients' eyes to that opportunity. And the veteran community, certainly that we hold, is such an untapped resource of incredible talent. You know, the core values that these people show, from integrity to work ethic to mindset to resilience to, you know, teamwork. You can't, someone doesn't just have that. They've either got that or they don't. They could learn a little bit, but you don't really pick that up and read that in a book.
But the issue, Joel, in my opinion, is down to a job catalogue, right? So, you know, if you take the top 100 roles in an average organization, right, those very few of those roles are going to overlay from a job catalog perspective to the roles that exist within any of our services. Simply because of the nomenclature, right? Yeah. Simply because of naming convention or how things are presented. Mm-hmm. If you break it down to skills instead of a job title and capability, then I think we'd have a much higher success rate, and also make that resettlement process much less daunting. You know, it's for anyone listening to this podcast that is about to go through what I knew it as resettlement. I don't know if it's the same terminology now, but the transition from service to civilian is hard. No matter if you have a job to go to, it's hard because you are learning to manage your life out of the conditions that have been beset upon you for so many years in many cases. What to wear, where to go, who to work with, what to eat, what time you're going, where you're going. All of that is conditioned and thought out for you. You then go into civilian street, and I tell you, the first big issue I had for a long time, I figured it out now, but what do I wear? You know, what do I wear? And where do I go? Like, You know, because what you wore out of service was, you know, an alternate uniform of jeans and a t-shirt.
A dinghy boot.
Yeah, exactly. And what do you wear? And then the process of figuring out who you are and what you do and how you're showing up in a place where you have so many choices. Whereas previously, a lot of those choices didn't exist because they didn't need to exist. So it can be really hard.
You know what's quite interesting is the big USP that we have here is that we don't just work with vets who are leaving week one, day one from the forces. We stay with them for the entirety of their career. So it's interesting watching people. I was talking with someone the other day who a couple of years ago was at level A. He's now transitioned, been promoted three or four times. So he's got experience across the board at a number of different levels. So that's the beauty, I feel, of our community, is that they do have experience in going from floor worker through to area director and all of the roles in between. So from a experience perspective, they're ticking those boxes. But certainly when you've been given such a structured way of living, as soon as that structure is pulled and you have to implement that structure yourself, that's where it can be challenging. And I have to say, when I left the forces, you know, I had an unbelievable identity crisis, you know, and to the point of, I had these stupid thoughts that, I'm no longer this, you know, fit, aggressive, tip of the spear paratrooper, and my mother and father would be less proud of me. And then when I think about that now and I look back to that, it's a very strange thing to be thinking that, isn't it? That's odd, because nothing changed from who I was the day before to the day I left. It's, you know,
the uniform gives us a sense of belonging, a sense of armor, a sense of community, and a sense of team that, you know, is really protective in many ways. It can also be restrictive, but it protects us and gives us a sense of who we are and owning our own narrative, right? And, you know, you in uniform walk 3 inches taller. I know I did, and I needed every inch of it at 5'1". But it gives you a sense of confidence. And when you take that armor away and all of the stuff that goes with being in the military, you can feel exposed, you can feel weaker, you can feel incredibly vulnerable, and a big part of who you are feels as if it's fallen away. It takes some time to get that confidence back. Yeah. That's why we see a lot of people in the military going to roles where they are incredibly overqualified, which is why we then see typically quite a lot of accelerated promotion for ex-military individuals. They go in, they've lost their sense of confidence and belief, they go in at a role lower than them, either through choice or by default, because that corporation might not recognize all of their skills and the job catalogue doesn't align. You then see these individuals being recognized and leapfrogging through the organizations quicker. You know, it would be nice if we could level the playing field a little bit and prevent that from happening, but that confidence is not something that the military can package up in a resettlement, you know, pack for people to take with them. It's for the civilian and corporate world to recognize and be much more accommodating in gifting back that confidence, supporting people in different
ways. That starts with just understanding the process they're going through. And that's where, again, you know, companies, you know, again, I keep reverting back to EMC, but we provide that consultative support to companies on educating them what that person's going through. So, Sam, I'm getting very aware of time. But the two final questions I'd love to throw before we conclude. First one, it's if you're talking to a company, what benefits do you feel a company will get from bringing a veteran into their workforce?
Oh, gosh. Well, where do you start? So you can start with loyalty and commitment, but you can also think about consistency of skill levels. You know, transferable skills that come from the military can play a huge role. You know, I think of things like project management, for example, complex people management in complex environments. It's you know, you're not getting just a person, you're getting a person with so many layers to their own fabric that the depth of skill that you can draw out of that person, if they are managed and led and guided well, is extraordinary. And, you know, I think people need to look much more broadly at military skills and ex-military personnel and say, okay, you may not be 100% fit for this, but understand that if they took not the risk, but open their eyes to the opportunity of that hire, actually they'd end up with 130% fit of what they were looking for.
Trainability of that person.
Trainability and, you know, the chameleon-like nature of skill sets for folks is huge. Also, don't underestimate the level of technical skill and competence that sits within the military. Okay, we all know archaic systems are in place, but also cutting edge technology. If you just think about drones.
You know, cyber.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge. So don't underestimate ever the ability of military personnel. Well,
that's a cracking answer. And my first final question to you of our podcast today is, if you could give advice to a military person stepping into that civvy world, going, turning up this morning, week one, day one, their first ever civilian career, what would you be saying to them?
Good luck. enjoy it. You know, enjoy the fact that it's so different. You know, don't worry about what you're wearing. It's a waste of time worrying about that. But be open to a new adventure and don't stress the small stuff. Find your people in that new environment that can be your sat nav and guidance. Navigating through corporate organizations can be incredibly challenging, so find your people. Again, it's, you know, that's my advice for every challenge. Find your people and they'll help you through it.
Wow, Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure, and we could sit here for hours, I'm sure, just chinwagging as we do. But listen, thank you so much for your input, your advice. You're an inspirational human to so many people, and I'm sure the many veterans who'll be listening to this podcast, seeing you being as successful as you are, knowing you're one of us, is, you know, that's just a beacon of hope for many. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Joel. Much appreciated.
Ex-Military Careers is a social enterprise which exists to bridge the gap between the military and the civilian world. If you want to find out more, please visit our website on www.x-militarycareers.com or follow us on social media. Together, we can bridge the gap between the military and the civilian life. But for now, stay safe and we'll see you soon.